All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. Let me give you a quick heads up on what we're doing here. First hour is Pittsburgh Power, and we are working on getting that all set up right now, just about there. So if you've got questions about engines, performance, fuel mileage, troubleshooting, ECMs, press 1 on your phone right now. If you do that quick, we'll be able to get to you. There's still some room there. Second hour is going to be Destination Health. So if you've got questions about health, fitness, diet, exercise, nutrition, any of those things, press 1 on your phone also right now. But we'll be screening you and holding those calls for the second hour. Now, there's usually a lot of room to get through if you do it early. So the sooner you press 1 on your phone, the better the odds that we're going to be able to get to you and your questions. So I would do that right now. Calls are starting to come in pretty heavy, but you've still got time. So we are just about ready to roll here. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call. We'll talk about it here on the air. Today is the Power Hour. And joining me from Pittsburgh Power will be Bruce, as well as John Walco and Ethan. We'll all be talking about whatever's going on at Pittsburgh Power this week. They've always got new and exciting stuff, and we'll be taking your calls and questions about engines, performance, fuel economy, troubleshooting, upgrades, modifications, ECMs, electrical systems, you name it. Give us a call and we'll answer those questions. So we're going to get to it right now. I'm going to bring on Bruce. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us, Kevin.
Well, great to have you back. And it looks like John and Ethan are joining us as well. Let's bring them in. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
To have you here. So, Bruce, what's new and exciting at Pittsburgh Power this week?
Oh, you know, since we started the Power Hour back this past month, each week we keep coming up with something new, and I keep thinking, well, maybe there won't be something new this week, but we have 3 new items for this week for you.
Oh, great. What are they?
We have found on a lot of D-deck 4s, once you resurface the block, there is not enough clearance to properly set the end gap on the cam gear and the bull gear. Because as you lower the block, the piston comes up in the bore, it raises the compression ratio, which we don't want to do. But it also brings the front gears closer together. So, John Walco had some friends in the racing industry where he came from, and they're building us a 10,000 thicker head gasket for the D-Deck 4. This gasket's going to cost about $300. It's going to save your block, and it's going to keep you from having issues with the cam gears, and that gasket's supposed to be ready this week, and we'll be installing our first one. Then it's great news. Cummins did that for the big cam. They made it 13,000 thicker. And we found that 13,000 actually would lower your compression ratio by a half a compression ratio, so it brings you back into spec. So we're going to be able to save. We have about 5 DDEC 4 blocks right now that we can't use. So that is why we decided to build that head gasket. Next thing, John and his father have a patent on a cyclonic separator. His father builds a truck, a vacuum truck, where as you're digging the hole in the ground, it sucks the dirt and the rocks up and it stores it in a hopper. And then when you're finished working on the pipeline or the electrical line, it just drops it back in. So John has the idea of building a cyclonic separator to separate the soot from the EGR gases before they get into the head and the intake manifold. So he's going to be talking about that. And Ethan and Leroy came up with an EGR tune-up kit. It's pretty extensive. It's about 8 hours to install it. And Ethan's going to talk about that. So do we want to start with John talking about the cyclonic separator?
Well, it sounds like we have all kinds of great stuff. Well, you know, let me jump in there and then we'll get started. $300 for that gasket to save a block, that's pennies. You know, some people might think it's an expensive gasket, but it's a whole lot more than a gasket. You know, it's saving the block, so that's exciting. The idea of separating out the EGR, the soot, from the exhaust gases, that sounds brilliant, so I can't wait to hear about that. And EGR tune-up, you know, that will solve many of the problems that I get on the show. I get so many questions about these EGR trucks and what people can do, and they're not running right, and we're clogging DPFs, and they've always got check engine lights, and their fuel economy is down. So anything that moves us in that direction would be a very exciting thing. So, yeah, let's get started. Let's let John jump in and talk about that idea.
Thanks, Kevin. Yeah, looking at these engines in the month that I've been here now and seeing the amount of soot, which is a particulate matter, which has mass in the intake, you know, that's made it the whole way over to the intake, it just got me thinking. And we've had a lot of success with a separation system that my father and I designed back in the early 90s, and we're actually able to have patented. And it's, you know, from a very high velocity airflow, we could pull almost talcum powder type third out of the airstream and separate it out and never have it make it to the filters on the machines that we build. So I've had an idea and I've got some sketches on my desk right now, and I'm going to build a prototype here in the next weeks of something similar to that to act as a passive filtration system in the EGR flow to the intake. My feeling is if we could pull half of it out, I'd be foolish to think that we could filter it all out without causing some sort of restriction, which is why it's got to be some sort of what we like to call passive filtration, meaning that it's not going to plug, it's not going to cause other problems, we're not going to have check engine lights related to the fact that our little filter and the EGR plugged up. It's going to rely on velocities of you know, flow going through it and lowering that velocity into a tank, shall we say, and using the pressure drop where it comes in to help keep the particulate matter in there in suspension and not allow it to continue up the top of the chamber. And so it'll basically be a trap that catches it at the bottom. And, you know, during your maintenance, say during an oil change or something, you pull the trap off and dump it out and put it back in. So that's the goal, you know, the parameters I've set forth to do it, and I would like to see it work. We may have some sort of a plate catalyst in there as well. I don't want to put any sort of matrix catalyst in that would plug, but some plates with some sort of catalytic material on them to help grab the stuff too, or burn it off as it goes through is another possibility. But that's what, you know, I've already ordered a few pieces to get going on it, and we're going to have a prototype ready here in a month or so.
Wow. Well, the idea is just absolutely brilliant, and I think if you are able to pull 50% of the soot out of there, I think that's a fantastic goal. I think the benefits would be huge.
Yeah, you know, you look at things like that and think, why didn't the manufacturer do it? But we have to realize that the manufacturers have got cost constraints and other constraints to work with that we don't. So if we spend $1,000 or $2,000 on a piece like this, that's great. But, you know, for Cummins or Detroit to do that, well, that's the bean counters are going to say, no way, you're not going to do it. We'll just have the end user's going to maintain this thing, or we're, you know, the head's going to have to come off every 500,000 miles or whatever. But we don't have those constraints to deal with, so we need to think outside of the box and try to come up with ideas like this to solve these problems, because it's not going away. We're not going to get rid of the EGR. I mean, technology or maybe tuning might get to a point where it's not as big of a deal as it is now, but it's here to stay, and we need to work on fixing it.
You know that what you just talked about there, I can't tell you how many times I've said those same things on the air, because I'm a huge believer in the aftermarket when it comes to, you know, performance upgrades, fuel mileage upgrades. There are so many things we can improve on a truck. I've said that there probably isn't a part on the truck that we couldn't improve. It's just a matter of working on the ones that are most cost effective. And people say, oh, but it, you know, if it were so good, the OEM would do it. Nothing could be further from the truth. The OEM knows that every part on that truck has been compromised in some way. It's not the best part you could build, because they have money constraints, and they always will. So even sometimes the things that are just drop-dead obvious, this would be better, you just don't see it on the OEM. So I agree with you completely.
Thanks. Yeah, I can't wait to get to work on it. It's I'd love to have something ready for one of the shows coming up.
Fantastic. So, all right, let's move on to the next exciting thing. Ethan, what do you guys have going on?
Okay, you know, normally we all hear the stories about the EGR and the DPFs having problems, especially the DPFs plugging up. The dealer's solution normally is to just treat the problem. You got a plug DPF filter, they burn it out, they replace it. You know, they don't actually solve why it keeps plugging up. And we're learning, especially as the trucks get a little higher mileage, and we've even lately seen new trucks we've been looking at and keeping an eye on.
Hey, Ethan, hold that thought. We're going to get to a break, and we're going to come back right after this. Stick around. We've got more to talk about, exciting stuff going on there at Pittsburgh Power. We'll get you a phone number if you want to talk to anybody over there, and we'll get to your calls and questions right after this break. All right, everybody, give me 1 second. I've got to make some adjustments here. List goes on. All right, here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. Joining me from Pittsburgh Power, Bruce and John and Ethan. And before the break, Ethan was telling us about their new EGR tune-up kit. Ethan, go ahead.
Okay, and we were talking about there how the dealers and the OEMs, they treat the problem. You know, they treat the symptom, not what's actually causing the problem. So we started paying more attention to looking, you know, elsewhere also. We know the DPF is clogging up, but why is it doing it so often? We all heard those problematic trucks that are out there that it's always doing it. So we started looking at the sensors that are in that control how the engine, you know, functions on the DPF and the EGR. And after pulling a lot of these sensors out, even some of the newer trucks, such as the DD15, the CM2250, you know, the new Common Rail Cummins, and finding that the boost sensors on almost all of them are plugged. And on some of these, they actually have a temperature sensor built into them also. And when that gets all carboned up around the, you know, the sensor, it can't read right no more. And the computer only knows what the information it gets. So the idea behind it is, you know, in intervals there, about every, you know, quarter million miles, it's not a bad idea to go through and just replace all of them. And when you do that, you know that your system's operating at 100% efficiency. The carbon and the soot is just it's destroying these sensors over time.
Ethan, you want to give a list of the sensors that we're talking about? Do you want to read that off?
Yeah, a lot of them, with the major one being the boost sensor there, and the you have the intake air temperature, the EGR delta pressure sensor, the exhaust gas manifold pressure sensor. There's the doser injector itself wouldn't be a bad thing to be replaced, the EGR valve, the temperature sensors. If you have a DPF filter, there's an inlet and outlet temperature sensor for the, you know, the diesel catalyst there. Let me think of any other ones. I think I got most of them there. And there's even a couple other sensors, depending on the truck, that they may need replaced.
Okay. So we found that with, like, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You finish.
If the, say, the temp sensor or the boost sensor is off a little bit, or the carbon, which is an excellent insulator, covers up the temperature sensor, and all of a sudden we've got bad data going to the ECM, and that's going to affect basically whether how the engine's burning, or the mixture, shall we say. So then you're going to accelerate a problem at the DPF or the DOC.
Ethan, you feel that every quarter of a million miles is soon enough to do this tune-up? Did I lose you? Hello?
All right, Bruce, are you there?
I am.
All right, let me see. Did we lose? I think we lost Ethan and John. I'm not seeing them up on the board. I think we just lost a whole bunch of internet connection there and a bunch of calls. So you and I will pick up. We'll start going to some calls, and we'll have them try to get them back on. So we were talking about the EGR tune-up kit, and Ethan just explained that to us. And Bruce, you were asking if 250,000 miles would be a good number to do that, or if maybe it should be done sooner. You know what I love about what we've talked about so far today? The idea, and I completely agree with Ethan, we all know this, nobody's really solving any problems on trucks. They're just fixing symptoms, throwing parts at things, trying to get the truck back out on the road. Nothing's been solved. And what we talked about today are two steps towards really solving the problem. First off, getting the soot out of the intake, 50% of it, I think, would be a huge improvement, which will stop a lot of that stuff from getting coated and dirty and clogged. And then identifying where the problems are, these sensors that are being coded, and then sending all kinds of wrong information to the ECM. This is really a two-step approach, and I think this could really make a big difference.
We think it could, too, and that way the people with the newer trucks can stay legal. They can continue to run California. They can continue to go into truck dealerships and not have their truck being held captive because somebody butchered up their emission system. And if we can do this every quarter million, talking with Ethan and Leroy this morning, with dyno testing, all the parts and labor, we're talking somewhere between $2,000 and $2,500, depending on the truck. So if you do that four times and you get a million miles out of your engine, you just prolonged the engine life and avoided the rebuild, plus all the downtime associated with EGR, DPF, and urea.
Well, Bruce, if you guys make even a small dent in the maintenance cost, and I think these two steps could make a huge improvement in maintenance cost, but just to give you an idea, I do the number side of things. You know, you guys are in there wrenching and developing and coming up with ideas and fixing problems, and I'm on the other side watching all the numbers. If we take a pre-emission truck, and to give you an example, when I sold my fleet, I had three pre-emission trucks that were all over a million miles, and my maintenance cost on all three trucks, the average for all three was about 7 cents a mile. Now, about the best I see on trucks after DPFs is about 14 cents a mile, almost double. And many of these trucks, 2012 and newer, show up at 20 plus cents a mile in maintenance cost. And there are a few exceptions. Every now and then you'll find one that is doing better, but not many. So if you take the low side, 14 or 15 cents a mile, and you shave just 4 or 5 cents off that with these two steps, and I think that's definitely doable. This isn't going to cost you $2,500. It's probably going to save you several thousand.
That's a great way to look at it. Yes, if we could get it down to 10 or 12 cents per mile, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, if you knock 4 cents a mile off it, it's almost going to pay for itself. That's only mate. We also know that when these trucks are running right, they get really good fuel economy. When they start screwing up, fuel economy goes in the tank. So if we start looking at the maintenance and the fuel savings, if this works out, and it certainly sounds like it could, you'd be crazy not to do this every 250,000 miles or maybe sooner.
Yeah, it could be a great thing for the industry and for the country and hopefully stop this rapid rate of inflation that we're under right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, what do you say? We haven't got Ethan and John back in the shop yet. What do you say we take some phone calls?
Let's do it.
All right, let's go to Arkansas. Tony, welcome to the program. Oh,
hi,
you know what? Tony, hold on 1 second. I'm going to put you back on hold. I just heard the music play. We are going to get to the break, and we'll come right back right after this. Stick around for more stuff. Kevin Robinson. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. Joining me from Pittsburgh Power is Bruce Mallinson. We were heading off to Arkansas. We're going to go back there now. Tony, welcome back. Go ahead.
How y'all doing? Yeah, I had a question about an oil sample. I'm getting a lot of fuel dilution in my engine for some reason.
Well, not only are you getting fuel dilution, we've got a pretty bad coolant intrusion as well. So let me just verify. What year is this engine?
It's an Well, it's an 04, but it was manufactured in 03.
Okay, so pre-EGR?
Well, yes. Yes and no.
Okay. Got it. I understand. 1.1 million miles, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, no.
Yeah, so we've got almost 7% fuel dilution, and it was high last sample. It's getting even higher now. Potassium is up over 800, and sodium's at 126. Those are clear indicators that we've got some major issues going on. The good news is it hasn't caused any other major problems yet. We're not seeing a lot of wear metals, but I don't think it's going to be long. You're going to have to get this thing in and get the top end looked at. Injectors and, you know, possibly a cracked head or a head gasket.
Okay. Now, I did have it, let's see, back in, I've got notes here, and June of last year, I had the rod and main bearings changed, and I was running synthetic oil up until then, and I was getting really low oil pressure. So I went back to a mineral oil. But I think the fuel dilution has always been high. It was up to like 4 before all this, and then, but my soot was also high up until I did.
Up until you did the bearings?
Well, up until, yeah, I did the bearings right after I did the a different exhaust manifold.
Okay. Well, you know, I don't see the oil itself causing any problems. The physical properties of the oil are fine. I'm not really seeing a lot of soot. It's just we've got both fuel and coolant in there. So we've just got the priority right now is finding the source.
Okay. I was told that I had the smaller injectors in it. It's a 12-7, but I didn't know if my program is turned up too hot, because if I'm low on the throttle, if I'm under 1450 RPMs, it smokes like a freight train. I mean, it's like a crop duster going off.
Well, let me, I've addressed the oil sample because I had it in front of me. I'm going to bring, we have Ethan and John back, and Bruce is on. Do you guys want to address what might be going on with the engine?
What horsepower is the 12.7?
Well, it was a 430, I think 470, 430. It had no power at all. It wouldn't pull a hill. Empty or bobtail, and now it's, if you get on the throttle now, it'll spin the tires.
Okay, whose program did you put in?
It's a place out of Kentucky.
Did they put all 75s in for the injector numbers?
That I don't know.
You need to get that truck
up
to our place.
Set.
Yeah, you need to get that truck up to our place, and let's do the ECM the proper way and get those 75s out of there, and let's get rid of that smoke and get this truck so it'll idle smooth and pull well. How many pounds of turbo boost would it make on a hard pull at 16, 17, 1800 RPM?
Probably around 60.
Oh, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous. See, these kind of people, they shouldn't be touching ECMs. 500 horsepower is 30 pounds of boost, so you could be making 1,000 horsepower out of that 12.7. And you're wondering
right.
Why you're seeing some problems? Set it up right, so it puts out a nice 600, 650 horsepower, and your problems will go away. You just need to get that truck into our shop and stay away from the ECM butchers. These guys that work out of truck stops and out of their vans and out of motel rooms, people have to stay away from these guys because they really don't understand ECM tuning. And they're not using a dyno, and they're not engineers, and they're just butchers. And we have a whole list of the people we could say are the butchers out there, but we're not going to say it over the air.
Okay.
One other note there.
Go ahead, the
60 pounds of boost for that little 12.7 is just way too much. I mean, you're creating so much cylinder pressure on that thing that it might even, like you said with the coolant, it might have a head issue already. And I've seen where programs dump too much fuel, they'll cause fuel dilution because there's just so much fuel going into the cylinders, it's pushing past the rings.
Well, you know, after hearing the settings and that much boost, I'm thinking that there may not be anything wrong with the injectors. The fuel dilution could be exactly what you just said, Ethan. And he said if he runs it under 1450, it's just pure black smoke. Well, you know how much fuel's going in the cylinder. So the injectors may be fine, but looking at all this coolant, I think he does have possibly a cracked head or a head gasket.
And we have to get that in and tune that engine right. I'm telling you, Kevin, the butchers, the ECM butchers are coming out of the woodwork.
Yeah, you know, they're starting to figure out, you know, how to go in and make lots of power like it's something really special. You know what these engines are capable of, but that's
right,
not the way they should run.
The way you make power is you make it refined power. Smooth, consistent performance, not just
absolutely
this kind of stuff. Just putting all these 75s in and on the Caterpillars, changing the FLS and FTS. These people are doing it the wrong way. So let's go on to the next one.
Let's move on to Tennessee. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. Good morning. I'm calling with a question about a fuel economy. Got an 06 Pete with an 05 ISX in it, 475. And normally I drive really soft, about 53, 55 miles an hour. And I have been teetering on by 6.8 to 7.05 on my fuel economy. And right at about Thanksgiving, things got cold. My fuel economy just fell on its face. And I am idling the truck more, so I know that contributes to it. But I know you guys have said something about, you know, Winterblend fuel and anti-gel, you know, having an effect on the fuel economy. But so I'm wondering if is there any kind of rule of thumb on, you know, if I weren't idling the truck or if I had a bump meter, if I was getting, say, a strong 6.75 MPG on, you know, normal fuel blend, what could I expect when the fuel blends change, given I keep everything else the same? I'm trying to distinguish, you know, what's the difference between what I've contributed to my fuel economy numbers going down between the idling and what's the better fuel. My overhead is at about 35,000 miles ago. I think everything else is running right on the truck.
Well, let me jump in and then I'll pass it over to you guys. Here's the thing. You know, when people think about fuel mileage dropping in the winter, they always think of the winter blend fuels, but that's only one of the factors, and it's actually kind of small. We do know that anytime we start blending winter fuels, we have less energy available in that fuel. But there are so many other factors going on. I'm going to get to a break. When we come back, I'm going to go through those factors, and you'll see that there really is no rule of thumb because there are too many variables in the factory. But let me get to a break. We'll come right back to that. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rock. Thank you. All right, a quick heads up. We're heading into the fourth segment. We're going to get to as many of the Power Hour calls as we can, and then we're going to come back for the next hour and do Destination Health. So if you have any health-related questions, jump in with those now. If you have any general questions, tax, truck, that kind of stuff, we may take those in the next hour as well. So if you haven't already done so, press 1 on your phone, and we'll start screening those calls. Here we go. We were talking with Jeff in Tennessee, and I'm going to go through a couple issues here and then hand it off to the guys at Pittsburgh Power so they can chime in. So when we look at wintertime, the fuel blend is just one factor. The cold temperature alone, every impact of cold temperature is bad on fuel economy. As air gets colder, it gets much more dense and harder to push through, so aerodynamics become a bigger problem. If the engine is running cooler because we're in extreme cold temperatures, the engine will not get as good a fuel economy. Every component through the driveline, the transmission, the differentials, the U-joints, all of those will have more mechanical resistance in colder temperatures. We tend to have more wind in the wintertime. We have slush, we have snow, we have rain, it just horrible conditions that all have a negative impact on fuel economy. We do tend to idle more. So when you look at that and you never know how much time a truck is going to spend in the worst of extremes, there are some trucks, if you stay south of I-10 all winter long, you may get your best fuel economy. But there's just too many variables, and not knowing how long a truck is going to stay in those conditions, it's hard to put a number. Well, it's impossible to put a number on it. I can tell you, though, that I have seen in the worst cases, trucks lose 2.5 to 3 miles to the gallon when nothing else is wrong, just because, and those are trucks that tend to stay, you know, up in the far north all winter long. So, you know, when I see a mile or two per gallon drop, I don't even worry about it. So, Bruce, you guys have anything to add to that?
I want to say a good friend of mine is a retired United Airlines pilot, and his biggest concern in the wintertime in taking off was how deep was the slush on the runway. He said the commercial jets do not have enough power to push the slush out of the way of the tire. So think about that when you're going down a highway and there's wet snow and it's slush and it's just spraying off your tires. Think of what that United Airlines pilot said.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, I get it. And I live in the Northwest, so I spend a lot of time on 80 and 90 and kind of the yeti during the winter. So I certainly have my fair share of, you know, cold and slush for sure.
I think you should try to get. I think you should try to get that truck in and check out the emission system on it, and possibly reprogram your ECM, bring your power up a little bit, and do a nice dyno tune on that truck. And I think you'd get your fuel mileage back.
That sounds like a plan. Let's head off to Texas. Eric, welcome to the program.
How you doing today, Kevin? How you doing today, Bruce?
Good.
I had a question about my fuel economy. I'm at a 7.6. I got a Cummins IXX. I've done everything to this truck. Got to go below OPS, anything you can imagine. The only thing I ain't got is a fast system. I just want to know if there's any more potential I can get out this truck with a light load. I could get about 60,000 pounds. I could get about probably like an 8.2 with a 80,000 pound load maxed out. I get like a 7.5. I'm trying to get an 8.5. I want to know anything else I could do to this truck to get that,
have you
reach my goal.
Have you installed our ported and ceramic coated exhaust manifold?
I don't know if I can install that because I have a emissions.
We make the manifold for the emissions engines. That's a quarter mile to the gallon right there and quicker turbo response for you.
Okay.
Also, if you can get into Pittsburgh, the program that we have for the variable geometry turbo will give you another quarter, half, or even three quarters of a mile of the gallon.
Okay. What about...
engine, so don't be afraid to come in and have us work on your programming.
I just had my programmer worked on at Cummins, but that's not the same program you guys have?
Oh, no. Not even close.
So I just wasted money. Because I went from a 450 to 550 RPMs. I mean, not RPMs, but horsepower is in 1,800 pounds of foot torque.
Well, that's not a waste of money. That's good, but we could do better.
Okay, how much is you? Can I send you my ECM?
It's best to have the truck. You can really dial it in while it's here.
Eric, I'm going to put you back on hold because we're getting a really bad echo on that line, and we're going to try to get to some more phone calls. We're going to head off to California. Justin, welcome to the program.
Good morning, gentlemen. What I've got is I got a 99 Freightliner with a 12.7 set at 500 horsepower, and the problem I'm having is over the last month I've lost 10 pounds of boost, and I can't find an issue anywhere in the motor that would cause it.
Any ideas, anyone?
The issues, did you pressurize it or do a smoke test on the whole intake system?
I pressurized the air charge. I've pulled and done a visual on the turbo. I've checked all the lines running across, and I can't find any leaks, any blockage. The turbo seems to be fine visually. I don't know how to test the turbo itself.
Interesting. Are you sure you're getting enough fuel?
I believe that I am. I mean, here's the thing: when I was looking at it the other day, the manifold and the hot side of the turbo seem to have started to blacken up, which they weren't like that before. And I'm under the assumption that it might be getting a little extra fuel.
Okay. Do you have a pyrometer in the truck?
Yes.
Has the temp gone up?
Yes, it has.
Okay. So it's not making boost for some reason.
Turbo boost gone down and the exhaust temp gone up?
Yes. The turbo boost used to read right around 30 pounds. It's the motor's all stock. I haven't done anything to it. The turbo boost used to read between 29 to 31 pounds on a pull. And the exhaust temp always seemed to me to be kind of low. It was down around 650 was the highest it would get. And now I'm running on roads, and I'm at about 10 pounds of boost, and I'm sitting at about 700 on the pyrometer.
Sounds like your waste gate.
At 1550.
That's all stock. It sounds like your waste gate might be stuck open. You want to try exercising the waste gate?
We did that on the weekend, and everything—it's all free, and seems to be operating correctly. And so I did take and I pinched the line on it, and tried it, and I didn't see any difference.
Right. Maybe the valve and valve.
I had to set the phone down. Is this a D-Deck 4?
Yes, it's a 99.
Okay. The 99 Detroit. Okay. So we're up in exhaust temp. First of all, your pyrometer is not reading correctly. If it was running only at 600 degrees, you don't get efficiency until you get to 800 degrees. So I think your pyrometer is reading off. But how many pounds of boost are you down right now?
10 pounds.
10 pounds. You're only running 20 pounds of boost?
That's all I can get out of it right now. And that's really getting on it where I didn't have to before.
Where do you live?
Central California.
Central California. So, needless to say, to get the truck to Pittsburgh is a problem, isn't it? Or is it?
It could be. Yeah, it would be a bit of a problem. I would have to hunt for a load to get out that way.
Well, you should, because for every pound of boost you lose, you gain 25 degrees. So you've just gained 250 degrees exhaust temp.
Yep.
You could be heading for a catastrophic failure and a $22,000 rebuild if you don't get the problem fixed. And you've got a turbo or air filter or charge air cooler or intake manifold problem. Or could it be going through your air compressor? If I were you, I'd be looking for a load our way today.
All right. Well, I will get on the phone and see if I can't get something to get back to your guys' shop then. I appreciate your time.
10 pound of boost loss is huge. You're down 33% of your power there, but you're still getting your fuel. So we know it's a boost-related issue and not a fuel problem. Kevin, do you remember the very first show I did with you in the Dallas Truck Show? We talked about that when boost is down and EGT is up.
I do, and that has helped me help a lot of people over the years. Wish we had a little more time to talk about it right now, but we've got to wrap it up and we've got to get right into the clock. Bruce, Ethan, John, thanks for everything. Thank you for that good stuff going on, and we'll get to the next week. Thanks again. Be safe. All right, everybody, we're going to do an hour of Destination Health. If you are on the line, I see there's a turbo boost question. I see there is an oil question, and I'm looking through what else we've got here. I will try to get to those in the next hour. We might have some time. We don't have a whole lot of questions right now on Destination Health. So we will get started, and we'll get to the questions, and then we'll take general questions if we run out, and if we run out of those, we'll wrap it up for the day. So if you've got, first off, any sort of health-related question, go ahead and press 1 on your phone right now. You'll be able to get through. If you've got general questions, go ahead and press 1 as well, and we'll get to one or the other. Here we go. We're going to get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to our world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. Joining me, my co-host, Kim Cockerham. This is Destination Health. The website is letstruck.com. You can also find us on the Destination Health page on Facebook. The show is all about you, your health, your fitness, your lifestyle, your well-being, and getting and staying healthier on the road. We'll take your questions and answer your calls about any of those topics, whether it's food, nutrition, health, disease, medication, training, fitness, you name it. We'll talk about it here on the air, and we're going to get to those calls in just a little bit. I'm going to welcome Kim right now. Kim, welcome back.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Doing great, doing great. I've got some updates I want to give today, and we'll get to you. And then I see some questions are starting to pop up, so we'll get to those. You know, last week I talked a little bit about kind of the whole journey. I am coming up on a year of grain-free, completely grain-free. That will happen second week in February. And, you know, I started just trying to eat better in general, and, you know, I didn't really know what that meant. I was still going by a lot of the old traditional kind of advice about low fat and better fats and all those things. And then I found a lot of information about all the problems grains can cause. You know, two books that I recommended, Grain Brain and Wheat Belly, excellent books. So I read those. They totally convinced me I didn't want to consume grains anymore. And then I moved from that to the ketogenic diet, very low carb, high fat, and saw tremendous benefits from that. And a couple of weeks ago, actually, I think it's been about a month, started not really moving away from the ketogenic diet. I still eat high fat, moderate protein, low carb, but not as low as what I was doing. I've been modifying my carb count and allowing it to climb to see what would happen. They're really high quality carbs, though. I'm eating sweet potato everything these days. I just love sweet potatoes, and I'm finding great ways to use them. A little more fruit, more of things like some kombuchas that might have a little higher sugar content than what I was willing to consume before. And the good news is, nothing's really changing except for the fact that I have a wider variety of food I can eat. I mean, my weight has stayed very stable. I feel great. I'm not getting any of the old symptoms back, no aches or pains. I'm sleeping great. In fact, I actually think I might be sleeping a little better. I tend to eat more of my carbs a little later in the evening. They say that that helps stabilize your blood sugar throughout the night. And it seems to be working well, so I'm kind of excited about that.
That's really cool, and I love the evolution of how it all happens. And I think I encourage everybody to embrace that, because, again, I think we were so, and I know I was, so on this on again, off again, you know, like that mentality of I'm on a diet or I'm not on a diet. This is just really a fascinating way to see what works for you, determine what your goals are, you know, too, and guide around that, and then, like you said, start adding things back in and experimenting to see how it works for your body. I'm the same way with sweet potatoes, and I was glad to bring it. I needed them back in as a good form of carb, and very happy with doing that. And I encourage everybody to look at that, look at their goals, and, you know, stay with the whole foods that we talk about and experiment and, you know, try new things. This is long term.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is, and I feel so much better doing it this way, and it doesn't feel like a diet to me anymore. It just feels like this is a good way to eat, and I'm paying attention to what happens in my body when I eat certain foods. And, you know, it's kind of interesting, because really I still am eating a high fat. Most of my meals, I still make sure there's plenty of fat in the meal, and I think that's a really good thing. I'm trying to make sure they're very high-quality fats. Moderate protein, but I do like meat, so I'm certainly not skimping on it. And on the carb side, I've just decided I'm going to eat as many vegetables as I want, and even throw in sweet potatoes and some more carrots and things like that. But I was a vegetarian for almost 4 years, and I probably eat double the number of vegetables I do now as I did then. The problem back then was, because I thought I was supposed to be eating low fat and I wasn't eating any meat, you know, you eat vegetables, but they're not all that satisfying. You're not getting enough calories, not getting fat with them, and I would substitute all the grains, a lot of pasta, a lot of rice, a lot of potatoes, a lot of bread, a lot of starches, and that just wasn't healthy. The longer I did that, the worse I felt. The beauty of this is I am eating a tremendous amount of vegetables now, which I love, but I've got the fat with them. I've got protein when I want it. And the longer I do this, better I feel.
Yeah, that's great. And I, again, love that back to the whole foods. I think we asked people last week to come on this week and share, too, how they eat whole foods on the road. Like, what are their strategies to prepare and stuff, you know, like that when they're on the road? Because I think that's key, and would love to hear how people are doing that.
Absolutely. Hey, I'm seeing the questions pile up. What do you say we get to some of them?
That sounds great. Thanks.
All right. Let's head off to Ohio. Herschel, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Kim.
Hey, Herschel.
Yesterday, I had my visit with the NTP. I'm a little confused, somewhat scared.
Uh-oh.
So I don't really know what to do. Really, the only thing that she advised at the time yesterday, she primarily did an interview and did a lot of history, which is good. I had cut down my fluid down to 40 ounces for the entire day to help the regularity, which did work. She doesn't agree with that. She thinks it should be more like 60 or 80, as long as it's water, of course. The only other thing she suggested food-wise was to eat a piece of fruit every day, and I told her about the ketogenic idea, so I'm thinking, well, I don't know what she's thinking there, but what she said is she would put together what she thought and then email it to me with suggestions and plans and ideas. So I went ahead and bought a one-month program from her, $325. If you do a six-month deal with her, it's $1,297, which cuts you down to $297 a month. So I went ahead and just did the 1 month to feel out what she knows, what she can do. She said that what she thinks my issue is a sluggish gallbladder, but didn't give me any direction or idea at all of what to do about it. So, you know, I don't know what to do, Kevin. I have no idea.
All right. Well, let me address that. And it's kind of unfortunate. I'm a little disappointed as well. But, you know, the initials are one thing. It's kind of like, mechanics and technicians. We talk with the guys at Pittsburgh Power, and they are just so sharp and so on top of everything and fixing things and solving problems. And there's thousands and thousands of mechanics who don't come anywhere near that level of knowledge and service. The NTP training, in my opinion, is top-notch. I love what they teach. I love the whole program. Unfortunately, you get people who go through the program, get the initials, and may not be at that level. I'm glad that she identified the sluggish gallbladder, but, you know, talking to you, I was leaning towards some digestion issues. I'm disappointed that she didn't do, did she do any supplement testing at all?
She did no testing. I asked her about it, and she said that she doesn't like to do the acid test to see how the stomach acid is because it's too harsh. She did give me and I'm probably going to get the name wrong. It's something licorice, and I forget the whole name of it, that's supposed to be a healer for the stomach, to do a quarter of a teaspoon in the morning and one in the evening, and that's really it.
Got it. Okay. Let me get to a break. I will come back and address that. You know, I think she's on the right track. I think she's just a little less aggressive than I'd like to see. So we'll talk about that when we get back. Stick around. Thank you.
back. I'm Kevin Rutherford, my co-host. Jim Cochran, him, his destination out. Before the break, we were talking with Herschel in Ohio. I'm going to go back to that. So, Herschel, here's the thing. She's kind of on the right track. The licorice supplement, not a bad idea. There could possibly be some damage. So healing supplements, healing herbs are never really a bad thing. But I think she's really missing the mark when she says she feels like the acid test is too harsh. It's not. The good, healthy stomach acid is strong enough to take chrome off of a bumper. And it doesn't hurt anything. Your stomach is designed to be that way. Now, what we find is that most people, it is very, very common to have low stomach acid, low in quantity and low in acidity, so a higher pH. The idea of the acid test is you just start eating a meal, and we make it a substantial meal. It should have carbs, protein, and fats. It should be good quantity. And as you're eating it, you start to take an acid supplement. It's just hydrochloric acid in a tablet. And you take it until you feel the acid. Now, we're not talking about, you know, retching pain or agony. I've done the test several times. You take it until you start to feel a little bit of warmth in your stomach. Some people will feel a little bit of acid reflux, like a heartburn, but not bad. And then that's it. You don't have to go any further than that. You know that that is your level. And if it's a lot, and I don't want to go through all the numbers right now, but if it takes quite a bit, then that helps us identify where many of the other problems are coming from. If it takes you a lot of acid supplementation to feel it, that tells us that you've got poor stomach acid quantity and quality. And that will cause all kinds of problems downstream. So now we've identified a way to start solving the problem by adding acid supplementation to the meal. So I'm disappointed that she didn't pursue that further.
Yeah, it was funny you said what you said just before the break, because, you know, I thought, and I truly did, I thought the same thing. And at the end of the visit, she posed the question to me, what do you want to do in the next 6 months? And I said, well, quite frankly, I want to be able to go to the John. I'd like to be so skinny I can hide behind a telephone pole. And if I walk by a woman instead of hurling, they go, hey, baby. And she just kind of looked at me. She said, well, I don't know if that all's going to happen. I said, well, you know, I mean, well, you said it. So there you are. But I thought the same thing. And I said, I am here because I am out of ideas. I've done everything I can do on my own. And I'm looking to you to tell me what to do, how to do it, what do you think? And she just wasn't aggressive enough. So I don't know. I'm going to give this first month a try and see what happens.
Herschel, what is the first month going to give you? I'm sorry, Kevin. I'm just curious what the first month, because to me, I might be – what I experienced with the person I went to, it's not going to be a quick thing, which I liked that. I was going to have to be patient with it. But I'm interested in what did she say she's going to work with you on for 1 month?
Well, from what I understood, she will be probably doing it now, I guess, and she will be sending me email to tell me her assessment of what I told her and then some guidelines. And I told her I am looking for direction. And the only direction she gave me was this cute little pamphlet of, you could go into it by category, butter being one, every kind of food you can imagine, and there's a list of good, better, and best for groups of food when you're at the store and which brands to buy, which ones are the best. That's really it. So I don't know what to think of it.
Well, like I, the idea is to get to the point where nutrition becomes the medicine. So I get that. I know where she's going. But what we find is that most people, the vast majority of people, have been on a Western processed diet for so long
that supplementation can jumpstart the process. I'm not a huge believer in a lot of supplements, and I don't really want to have to take any supplement forever. But to address the, first off, the stomach acid issue, I think would be important. And you could do that on your own. You could go get some hydrochloric acid tablets, and maybe I'll even put something together as far as a recommendation. And you could do that test. It's fairly simple. I just explained it. You sit down to a good substantial meal with fat, protein, and carbohydrates. About 2 minutes into the meal, you take one of the tablets, you wait 2 minutes. If you don't feel anything, you take another one. You do that every 2 minutes while you're eating, chewing your food well. And when you feel something change, when you feel a little heat, a little burn, maybe even a little heartburn, just note the milligrams you took, and that becomes your starting point. And when you eat, I would supplement the acid for now. Whatever healing herbs she gave you, the licorice, I would continue with that. But the fact that she mentioned you have a sluggish gallbladder, she should have tested some gallbladder supplements and found out what you respond well to, because if the gallbladder is sluggish, diet alone may not jumpstart it. There are some foods that are good for the gallbladder that'll thin, but it doesn't even sound like she made those recommendations. What we want is we want the bile to be thin and flow better. That's what causes a sluggish gallbladder, is the bile gets thick and sticky, and there are foods that would help that. There are also supplements that would help it. So I guess maybe she wants more time to kind of look over it, and then, so you paid for the month. Let's see if she does that. If she doesn't address the stomach acid and the gallbladder and make some food and, you know, supplement recommendations to solve that, then I would say it's time to find somebody else.
Okay. Good enough. I thank you, Kevin. I'll update you later on and see how it goes.
All right. Thanks for the update on that.
Thanks,
Kim, Kim, it's unfortunate. You know, I'm impressed with the NTP program. I love the way it's been laid out. The training is excellent. The process works. But you get people who just will go through the training, get the initials, and then not really follow what the whole program is all about. You know, I say it all the time with things as simple as tires on trucks. There is a clear method for mounting a tire properly. And when you don't, it causes problems, and yet we see it day in and day out. I can go to tire shops all day long and watch them just shortcut the whole process. And, you know, the same thing happens in the medical field, even when we seek out the right designation. So sometimes it's just a matter of you have to keep doing the hard work till you find somebody that works for you.
Yeah, and you know what? Herschel's been a great example to me of that, too. And I know he had a lot of, you know, hope going to this appointment, and that's hard when it doesn't quite, you know, measure up to what you're looking for. But I got to hand it to him for, you know, still, you know, staying the path and trying it. And he's just a great example to me of that, and, you know, other people out here. So appreciate him coming on and sharing, and looking forward to hearing more.
He is a great example, and I want other people to pay attention to that, that, you know, he didn't just call the show one time, ask a couple questions, and think things are going to get better. He's doing the work, and he's willing to try, you know, anything that makes sense, and that's what it takes. I mean, it's, you know, we keep trying things. What works, what doesn't work, let's keep doing this, let's stop doing that, let's find another practitioner. So Herschel's doing that, and he will get there. So I'm confident of that. Let's get to some more phone calls. Let's go to Texas. Paul, welcome to the program.
Howdy.
Hey there.
The beef that I buy at home, it's only grass-fed for the last 30 days, but I suppose a month worth of grass better than no grass at all, right?
Yeah, actually, that's better than what we do here in this country. So let's talk about three different ways the animals could be raised, especially beef. The worst case scenario, and what we see a lot of in this country, is the animal is feedlot, factory farmed, right from day one. Never really sees grass, never sees a pasture, and that is the worst quality meat we can get, and unfortunately it's everywhere. We also have a lot of animals that spend the majority of their life in pastures, on grass, you know, on farms. Unfortunately, towards the end of their life, because of our whole system, they have to get shipped off somewhere, usually far away, to a feed lot where they get finished on grains for 30 days or so, and backed up and then slaughtered. And that last 30 days really kills the quality of that meat. The changes in the background. The type of fat are Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rothfuss. Tim Cochran is my host, co-host. This is Destination Health. We're talking with Paul in Texas. So, Paul, here's the problem, and here's why we want grass-fed beef. One, it's just cleaner, healthier, but the real key part is the type of fat that's in the animal. So we need, in our diet, we need a better balance between omega-6 and omega-3. The ideal human balance, they say, is 1-to-1. The American diet is about 25-to-1 omega-6 heavy. It's horrible. Yeah, it's not even close. So when we feed animals on grains, the omega-6 content goes way up, and the omega-3 almost disappears. And that ratio can change in just 30 days. So your way, at least they're finishing on grass, and the omega-3 should go up and the omega-6 should go down. So I'd much rather see that than what we do. The other thing I know, when you say home, you're talking about New Zealand, right?
No, actually, I meant here. But the
In Texas.
We have a meat guy. He comes around, and I only found out just recently that it's good quality, and I only found out recently that it's finished off for 30 days on grass. It's grain fed at the start, and then it's finished for 30 days on grass before it goes to the freezer. So I guess it's not too bad.
No, that's a much better way. I thought you were talking about New Zealand, and I was surprised.
No, that's all grass all the time.
All grass all the time. Yeah, I was going to tell you the next time you go home, if there's any way you could bring me a couple cows. No, a couple cows.
Oh, holy cow. And then the other day you said, you know, some people, they don't have a tolerance for dairy products. Well, my grandfather, when he lived to be 92, and he would not drink milk till it went sour, and he would not eat cheese till it started growing mold. And he'd cut the moldy piece off, and he'd eat the moldy piece, and he'd say, the rest of it's not ready yet. And I can remember that as plain as day. He drank sour milk and ate moldy cheese. And I can never remember him being sick, ever.
There's a reason for that, and that is the wisdom that we used to have about food that we've lost. When milk goes sour, whether it's sour cream, yogurt, any of the cultured milk products, what's happened at that point is the lactose has been digested by the bacteria that's making it sour, so the lactose goes away, which is one of the things we're intolerant of. And the proteins that disagree with the human body are also consumed, and the product that's left is very healthy with no negative side effects. So you find the healthiest societies that do eat dairy almost always make it, one, it's raw and fresh, and two, it's usually cultured. So, you know, that we, like I say, we have a lot of wisdom about this, and your grandfather understood. He may not have known why, but he knew what worked.
He just said it tasted good to him.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, there is a large population in the world. Most people in the world are lactose and dairy intolerant. But if you prepare the dairy properly, Kim, remember, you know, the saying, properly prepared, nutrient-dense whole food. And properly prepared when it comes to dairy is usually fermenting.
Yeah, I love that. And I write that down again because I was trying to find that. I think all of us should have that written down and in front of our face because that's just back to the basics and just so perfect.
Yeah, you know, we forget the details. We think, oh, you know, we go back and forth. Is milk healthy? You know, we were raised to believe milk was healthy, calcium for your bones, all that stuff. But the way we eat dairy is not healthy at all, not even close. We pasteurize it, which just kills all kinds of all the good stuff. We homogenize it, which destroys the quality of the fat that is in there. We take the fat out, which really causes problems, and we're getting the milk from cows who had a horrible diet. I mean, nothing about the milk we typically eat is good, but that doesn't mean milk can't be good. If you start from a grass-fed organic cow, you take the raw milk, which is just loaded with all kinds of great stuff and good healthy fats and omega-3s and good enzymes and good bacteria, and then you culture it, which would get rid of or greatly reduce the lactose, which could cause people problems, and minimize the milk proteins that could cause problems, now you truly have a healthy food. They look the same. There are no similarities.
Very fascinating. Yeah. So, and especially people on the road, where do, and I guess I go back to what Matt had offered before too, like a link. Where do you find, I have never even searched out raw milk. I'm not a big dairy person. So where do you find it out on the road?
Yeah, it I don't have the link right in front of me and I don't remember the website either. I do know that if you go to the Weston A. Price Foundation, And the Weston Price Foundation is actually kind of the core of the NTP program. Weston Price was the dentist who, you know, realized that, you know, native people on their native diet didn't have all the dental problems that he was seeing in his practice. And he traveled the world and documented how healthy these people were that were eating native diets. And their teeth were healthy and their jaws were healthy and they didn't. You know, they didn't have the typical dental care that we have, and yet they had these amazing teeth their whole life. And he kind of founded the whole nutritional movement. And on that website, WestonAPrice.org, you will find links in every state to raw dairy that you can buy. I don't a lot of dairy either. I'm slightly lactose intolerant, I think, at times, and yogurt, you know, it's so hard to find a good quality commercial yogurt. Every once in a while, I'll buy some raw milk and I'll make some, but it's not that I don't like it, I just don't like it enough to do all that work, and I find that, you know, I eat a lot of raw milk cheese, and that's much easier to find. So that's really kind of the extent of the dairy in my diet is mostly raw milk cheeses.
Okay. I want to check out that website. That sounds like a great resource.
Yeah, it is. Let's go to Missouri. JD, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Hi, Kim. I started on the grain free about the same time you did, Kevin. Actually, independently, I heard you talking about it, and I'm like, oh, hey, that's what I'm doing. And
oh, good.
I got really into the ketogenic in May of this past year when I was 350 pounds out of my brother's house in Colorado, and he literally just about gave me four heart attacks in one day climbing around the mountains in these old gold mines on his property out there. And I got really serious about it, and I have dropped 85 pounds.
Wow.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
I just did my DOT physical 2 weeks ago. And for the first time in my life, I had to go back the next morning to pass the blood pressure test.
What did you test at the first test?
The highest I tested was, how did the blood pressure go now? 165 over 80 or something like that.
Okay.
Finally, the next morning, I got down to 140 over 80.
Okay, so there's a couple things that tells me, and I wouldn't be too worried about this. You had a higher systolic, which isn't as much of a concern, and it was a one-time thing. And then you came down to a much more normal reading. So the good news is you passed. The great news is you've lost 85 pounds. That's amazing. What I would do if I were you, blood pressure is one of those measurements that can be all over the board. There are lots of things that can temporarily raise blood pressure. Doctors' white coats happen to be one of them. There's a well-known phenomenon that people test higher when they're in the doctor's office.
The nurse was pretty attractive, too.
There you go. So, yeah, now we know what's going on. So what I would recommend, you can get a good automatic blood pressure cuff for under $50. I would get one, and I would start testing your own blood pressure multiple times a day. And then we can identify if really have a problem or not. And if so, blood pressure is usually fairly simple to make adjustments in the diet and bring it down. So, but let's not get too crazy. Get the blood pressure cuff and start checking your own multiple times a day with patterns. And we'll be back to talk about it. Stick around, we'll be right back. This is Destination Health. My co-host is Kim Cockerham. And, Kim, that is amazing. I love hearing that, 85 pounds. A little bit of high blood pressure, it doesn't concern me at all because the health benefits that he has created by eating this way and losing that amount of weight is tremendous.
Yeah, I'm so proud of him. That is so great, JD. Keep it up.
Absolutely. Let's get to some more phone calls. Let's go to Maryland. Lena, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good. What can I help you with today?
My question was to you was that you said you've gone on the ketogenic diet, but my problem is, I guess, finding like that sample diet. Like, so tell me what your day consists of when, you know, you started the diet.
Sure. And I'll go through mine, and then, Kim, you can go through yours. I'll go through when I was strictly ketogenic, when I was testing for ketones, and I was trying to get my ketone levels up as high as I could. And then I'll go through how I've adjusted that now to a little more of a paleo-style diet. So when I was fully ketogenic, I wanted to lose weight. I wanted to solve some problems, sleep issues, pain in my joints, arthritis, things like that. My typical day would be, I usually get up pretty early, 4:30, 5 in the morning. I would have a cup of bulletproof coffee, which is coffee with grass-fed butter, 2 tablespoons of grass-fed butter, and 2 tablespoons of virgin coconut oil, and about a teaspoon of raw cocoa, raw cacao. Every now and then I might use a very low glycemic sweetener and blend it. That's, you know, 5:30 in the morning, I'd have my first cup. About 10 in the morning, I would start to feel a little hunger, and I would do it again. Another cup of bulletproof coffee. So my first meal normally wouldn't come till sometime between noon and 1. And I felt amazing starting my day off like that. Then my first meal would typically be high in fat and protein, and only a little bit of carbohydrates. So a typical lunch for me could be half a slab of ribs. My carbohydrate for that meal would be usually a homemade coleslaw with shredded cabbage, carrots, other vegetables, and I would make my own slaw dressing from homemade high-fat mayonnaise, good fats. I might put some dairy, like a sour cream, in there. Now, you could substitute, you know, good quality commercial varieties. I tend to cook everything from scratch because I love to cook. So that would be a possible meal. If I was in a hurry and I didn't have something cooked already, like if I'm going to do ribs, it's probably because I smoked, you know, 4 racks a couple days before and I just have them and they're there. Coleslaw, I could throw together quickly. If I'm in a little more of a hurry, I would grab something like, you know, summer sausage and cheese with, again, some good quality homemade mayonnaise and a handful of nuts. And it's amazing how that little meal would be so satisfying, even after not eating all morning. At night, I would tend to make that my meal that has more carbohydrates. So that one might be, you know, a stir fry, a vegetable stir fry that I started with either a really good quality grass-fed butter or ghee or coconut oil. Saute a bunch of vegetables. If I had a protein around, I might eat a chicken thigh with the skin on. A rotisserie chicken, because they're always easy to grab. If I wanted to snack, it would usually be something like nuts. Macadamia nuts I love. Almonds are good. Cashews. And surprisingly, that was all I was eating. And that wasn't really a lot of quantity of anything. But I was totally satisfied all day long, and I had tons of energy. What happened was if I continued to eat that way, I actually lost more weight than I wanted to. I got down to a lower weight, and that was when I started adjusting my carbs back up and started adding in, maybe for breakfast, Lisa makes these amazing grain-free pancakes that are just unbelievable. And I'll eat those with some grass-fed butter and some berries. So that's, you know, upping my carbs. Now I'm going back to more sweet potatoes. I don't worry about eating a lot of vegetables, even at every meal. Have you ever tried fermented vegetables like real kimchi and things like that?
No, I have not. But I guess. Where I have the problem is, like the macadamia nuts, the almonds, I'm allergic to them. So I can do cashews and I can do pistachios.
Okay, both of those are good. Yeah, anytime you've got an allergy or an intolerance, definitely stay away from them. But cashews, pistachios are excellent. Walnuts, can you eat walnuts?
No. Isn't that crazy? Okay. Yeah, I can't eat that. The flip side to that is I can eat peanuts, but I know peanuts, they're saying, are not good for you.
They're really not. Peanuts aren't nuts. They're legumes, and they have a very high occurrence of mold toxins that just aren't good. So I would stay away from peanuts. But eat the pistachios, the cashews. How about seeds?
Sunflower seeds. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can eat those.
Those are an excellent snack. Very good, high quality fats. They're satisfying. Find them organic and clean. Those are really good. Are you okay with cheeses?
Yes, but I had recently did a detox where we took dairy out of my diet, and I found that the bloating that I get in my stomach went away. So I was trying to stay away from dairy.
That's a good idea, and what you did is a really good idea. It's called an elimination diet, where you take things out that are common problems, see how you feel, and then you can start to add some back in. Here's what I would recommend. Find a good organic raw milk cheese. You can find them at Whole Foods, almost any health store. Some of the grocery stores are starting to pick them up, and try that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you try it and you get any of those negative symptoms, then you know dairy is just out for you, and you're going to have to find something else. How about avocados?
Avocados, I can eat them to a certain extent, but then they make me feel like a little sticky. Like, you know, like I feel like,
So here's what I think we need to do. When you start showing up with a lot of food intolerances, I wouldn't call yours allergies. I would call you've got quite a few food intolerances. That normally points to a digestive problem. So the digestive system is so important, and many times once we fix it, these food intolerances go away. Not all of them. Some of them are true allergies and they're not going to go away, but many will. So when if you heard talking about the stomach acid test, where you actually take acid while you're eating, that's the start of the digestive process. So I would go through that. And then there could be some gallbladder issues, because it sounds like foods that are high in fat are causing you the problems. Too many avocados, could be the dairy fat causing the problem, could be the high fat in the macadamia nuts causing the problem.
Okay.
If that's the case, let me ask you, do you still have your gallbladder?
Yes, I do.
Okay, good. It sounds like you could have a sluggish gallbladder, and you're having problem digesting the fats, and it's showing up as an intolerance.
Okay. Okay. So should I go back to my doctor? Is this something that I can do on my own?
No.
The
doctor won't have a clue. You can do it on your own. If you do enough research, I could give you some ideas on where to start. Or if you can find, where do you live?
I'm in Eldersburg, Maryland.
If you go to the website nutritionaltherapy.com, nutritionaltherapy.com, and there's a menu item for providers, and you can search for an NTP, a nutritional therapy practitioner, in your area or areas that you go to a lot. And one of the first things they should do, if they're following the protocol, is go through those digestive issues that I just talked about and show you how to improve them and ultimately solve them. So based on you're telling me, I think that's what needs to be addressed. I think you've got to get the digestive system intact, and then you may find that a lot of the food intolerances go away, and you'll be able to do the right thing. Kim, we did it again. Any final words?
No, I just love everybody being here. Keep up the great work. Focus on all the good candy and live well.
Fantastic. Thanks as always. Be safe. No problem. right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Today I'll remember to end the show and turn my mic off. Yesterday was a little crazy. I was having all kinds of audio issues. I can't believe I was like 300 yards away in the house and my mic was still on.
That's funny.
Well, thanks, Kim, and we'll do it again next week.
Thank you, Kevin. Sounds great. Have a great week, everyone.
Take care, everybody.